Good evening. Venerable Treasure in Stealing Taiwan. And so today we're going to do a review. We're going to start on page 44, Emotions and Clashes. So let's start by setting our motivation. After 3 months of being in retreat, and not having access to the news or any form of mass communication, I ventured into a few of the recent headlines to take a pulse on the state of the country and the state of the world. And all I needed to do was just read a few headlines to get the picture. Not much change, really. Just stories about human suffering, about anger, jealousy, greed, despair, and so on. And looking at what's happening in the world, it'd be easy to point to other people, other groups, other countries, and say, well, they are the cause of my suffering. They are the cause of all the problems in the world. If I could only get rid of them, if I could only separate myself from them, then everything would be fine. I would be at peace. I would enjoy prosperity. I would enjoy freedom and happiness. But the Buddha taught that the causes of suffering do not lie outside of ourselves. They do not lie with other people. They do not lie with other countries. They do not lie in objects, situations of any kind. The causes of suffering are in our own minds. The way we think, the way we view the world, the way we see others, the way we see ourselves. These wrong conceptions lead us to act in ways that result in our suffering and the suffering of others. This is the real cause. And the Buddha encouraged us and challenged us to look deeply within ourselves, to understand our suffering, and to identify and abandon the causes of that suffering. This is no small task, because we're not used to seeing things that way, because we stubbornly hold on to the same views and ignorance that have led us to where we are. And so it takes a lot of listening, a lot of contemplation, and a lot of meditation to really, really get familiar with what the Buddha was trying to tell us. Get familiar to bring it into our mind, to let it permeate our thoughts and our actions. So let's review these amazing teachings of the Buddha tonight with the thought of really understanding what he was telling us, so that we can practice it, so that we can realize it and embody it for the benefit of all sentient beings. that may we eventually become a Buddha ourselves and lead others on the path to Buddhahood. So we are in the section titled Emotions and Kleshas, which starts on page 44. In talking about emotions, I recall Venerable Trudrin talking about different approaches between how the Tibetan culture and Western culture look at emotions. And she was amazed that at present time, there's no widely used Tibetan word that directly translates the meaning of the word emotion. She quoted Thubten Jinpa saying that in English, there's a whole wider range of words to describe emotions than in Tibetan. Venerable went on to say that we're always talking about our emotions, our feelings, and how our feelings get hurt, how somebody hurt our feelings. I feel this, I feel that. So imagine for a moment a culture that doesn't even have a word for emotion. She asked us to imagine a culture where people are not always talking about their own feelings, about their own emotions. And she said that if there isn't a word for something, then we don't even see that something because we don't have a word or a concept for it. So imagine a culture that sees things differently because they don't have a word for it. And especially because in the West we put so much time and emphasis on our emotions and energy. So imagine if we were to use that energy for other things like studying and contemplating and meditating on Dharma topics. I found this wonderful website on the internet. It's called the Positive Psychology Program. It's a website, and found this quite interesting article written by a woman named Hokuma. They only gave her that name. They didn't give her last name, just Hokuma. And the title of the article was, "Can you guess how many emotions a human can experience?" You have any guesses out there? 300. Not even close. Other guesses?
I'm scared.
Close, very close. But the thing is, let me tell you, the answer was 34,000. With the ones the Venerable Chuni mentioned being foundation, and I'm going to name them, joy, sadness, acceptance, disgust, fear, anger, surprise, and anticipation. So according to Dr. Robert Plutchik, who's an American psychologist, he proposed that these are the eight primary emotions that serve as the foundation for all the others. And this article quote a number of researchers, Pollack in 2016, Watkins in 2014, Pico in 2016, and they're all talking about how these 34,000 distinguishable emotions are the primary emotions that are expressed in the human range. And so what they talked about is a range of emotions, not necessarily, you know, when we think about anger, we know that somehow we can feel things like minor irritation, we can feel even all the way to rage. So there's a spectrum, you know, in anger, for example, there's also annoyance, which are minor elements of anger that then as we become more and more drawn into that emotion, it can explode all the way to rage. And so There are others, for example, he was quoted in terms of grief. One of the minor elements of grief could be pensiveness, and then escalated to sadness, and then escalated to full-blown grief. So there is an entire wheel that depicts all of these different ranges of emotion. In fear, for example, it can start with apprehension, go up to fear, and then go all the way up to terror. And if you kind of look at your own experience with these emotions, you can see that you have experienced some of these, the minor levels, all the way to the full-blown emotion. So I thought this was quite interesting, because it does give us more tools to begin to identify when these start arising. Because if we understand when these start arising, it's easier for us to counter them, to provide an antidote, or to find a way to stop them from exploding into something that we don't want. And then following the comments from Venerable when she taught this section, she was talking about how in Buddhist translation, the word feeling does not mean the same as in regular colloquial English. In Buddhism, feeling refers to the states of being happy, unhappy, and neutral feelings. And she mentioned the 6 root afflictions and the 20 auxiliary afflictions, which then expand to 84,000. And these are called the kleshas. And I thought that the 84,000 mentioned here and the 34,000 mentioned here, well, there's some correlation between those afflictive state of mind and what we call just regular emotions. However, the word affliction can refer to many, many things in English. For example, we say we have an affliction when we are sick, you know. And so it doesn't really convey the exact word of what klesha means. There is really nothing in our language that encapsulates all of those things that the word klesha encompasses. There is not a good translation for it at this point. One of the things that is encompassed in this word klesha are deeply seated perspective and views and assumptions about the world and ourselves. One of these includes the view of an inherently existent person, a person that does not rely on other things, that is it's independent of causes and conditions, and also thinking that things are permanent. These are all wrong views that are included within the term of kleshas. So from the book, there's this passage that says, these disturbing emotions and views enslave the mind, confining it to a narrow perspective, which motivates our actions that hinder happiness of both ourselves and others. And this is something that we can see, even just looking at our own actions and also the state of the world, how when we let these disturbing emotions run the show, we create a lot of the situations that are normally featured in the news. Mm-hmm. Stealing, killing, lying, all of these things have as a root cause these disturbing emotions. Venerable talked a little bit about how we put people into camps of being friends, enemies, and strangers. And we do that because we hold so tightly to this view of self versus the view of others. And we hold so tightly to our identities, to ideas, that attachment to these things creates that differentiation. If someone criticizes me, then they go into the enemy category. And if someone is my friend or if does something nice for me, then they go into the friend category. And these categories change. She She talked about how from children we are taught to hate, we are taught what to like, what not to like, how we're exposed to the prejudices of our parents. And she explained that these are acquired afflictions. They're not innate afflictions. We acquire this ignorant way of thinking as we grow up in different environments and different cultures. For example, this thought of race, which is a big thing in human culture. And she talked about how our cats don't think about that. They don't think about colors. They didn't learn to differentiate that. And we learned that we are supposed to be offended by certain things, that we are supposed to desire certain things. We learned that success means certain things, and we learned that we have to go to be successful, we have to compete to be successful, we have to challenge others to be successful. So all of these are acquired afflictions that we have to identify, and as part of our practice, we have to let go of. And so I wanted to share a story about something that had happened to me not too long ago. I was talking with two friends, and one of them said something that I did not agree with. And I observed my reaction. My body experienced something like an electrical current. It was very mild. And there was a sense of unease, maybe even mental pain, and some disappointment. Later, remembering the conversation, I said to myself, this person is not safe. I need to relate to them differently. This was the first thought. Then later, after some time, another thought came up, remembering that incident. And the thought was, well, this person cannot be trusted because they think differently. I have to distance myself from them. I have to treat them differently. After a while, another thought came. I think it was the following day. I need to... I cannot be myself with this person. And then it dawned on me that what I was doing was turning a friend into an enemy in my mind. It became clear to me that as soon as I started to think that this person is not safe for whatever reason, I was immediately putting them into the enemy category. And then because they're now in this other category, then I begin to treat them differently. I begin to treat them as a real enemy, even though just a few days ago they were a friend. And this was all very automatic and very unconscious, and very fast. And the only reason I was able to catch this progression of thoughts was because we just finished the retreat and my mind had experienced, my mind had slowed down quite a bit after 3 months of retreat. And so I could see the arising of all these thoughts and all of these attitudes, the changing attitudes towards this one person. And then I thought, wow, I'm beginning to build this wall. It's really a wall between me and this other person. I'm pushing them aside. I'm making them the target of my hostility, and I'm saying to myself, it's okay to be hostile and ignore them or mistreat them because they think differently, because they're not safe. They are the one to be avoided. And it all started because that person did not agree with me. And I became very concerned at that point. I became very concerned because in order to develop bodhicitta, we cannot leave anyone out. We cannot have walls between us and others. We cannot create enemies. We need every single sentient being. So how I started to backtrack out of that trap, out of that mental trap, was by going back to seeing the kindness. This person did not agree with me in this particular situation, but look at all the other things that this person did for me before that. Look at all the contributions that they've made to my well-being, to my happiness, just in the time that I have been here. They've cooked, washed dishes, do the laundry, cleaned the premises. This person have said kind words to me. And so by remembering that, just backtracking and then making a really concerted effort to connect, to reconnect with the person, to reestablish them as friends in a genuine way, because I didn't want to do it in a pretend way. I didn't want to do it in some kind of a fake mode. And so really showing them kindness in return. And that worked very well. It took a couple of days to undo that one thought. This person is not safe. And everything that came after that, it took a couple of days. And it took a couple of days of concerted, very deliberate effort. Not really forced, but rather acknowledging that this person is important to me. I depend on this person. My happiness depends on this person. And so I was very grateful that I had received these teachings and that I was living in an environment where putting them into practice is being supported so well. But although all people have all of these emotions, not all of them have the great fortune to know how to deal with this. And so they go through their lives creating enemies in their minds. And so the book says that, you know, all people have this same emotions, same attitudes and views. Some of which are conducive to long-term happiness and peace, but others are hindrances, like the ones I was just referring to, like those attitudes that I was just talking about in my example. And there are some behaviors that are, and certain emotions that are socially acceptable in some cultures and some others are not. For example, in some cultures, it is a social norm and is expected to hug and to kiss friends as a way of greeting. And it's considered very impolite not to do that. I mean, if you don't, like in Colombia, for example, in any Hispanic country, if you go to a friend's house or meet a friend on the street and you don't hug them, kiss them, there's something wrong with you. It's like, are you mad at me? Did I do something to you? Whereas if you look at countries in Asia, you're not supposed to touch people. It happened to me at a retreat. I went to a retreat. Vipassana retreat, actually. And I was very used to this touchy-feely thing. It's part of my Hispanic heritage. And, you know, for days there, you don't talk to people. You're in complete silence. I was deprived of touching. And I was also very much deprived of speaking. And when the last day came and we were able to speak, the first thing I did was reach out and touch and a woman that was there. And her reaction was like, oh! And I was like, oh gosh, did I do something wrong? So this can get us, these different norms and can get us into some kind of a sticky situations. In some cultures, students in elementary and high school stand up when the teachers come into the classroom, and some others don't. Venerable also was talking about how some behaviors are okay for men and some are frowned upon. The same behaviors are frowned upon in women. Like in the workplace, for example, you have a man who is competitive, who is fierce in his work, who is aggressive, and they are labeled, you know, a success. They are applauded and encouraged. If a woman shows the same traits, they're called all kinds of unpleasant names, which I shall not repeat. So, displays of human emotion and human cultures, different human cultures that we have acquired in this life, and that may or may not support our spiritual development. And the words, according to the book, the words that we use to label emotions have many nuances. And there may not always be an exact correspondence in meaning between the Sanskrit or the Tibetan word and the English term used to translate it. And Venerable made a very important observation that we should not impute the colloquial meaning of a word to a word that has a specific meaning in the Buddhist system. For example, as I mentioned before, the word feeling in English refers to our emotions. But in the context of Buddhism, it refers to pleasant, unpleasant, and neutral feelings. Doesn't refer to love or hate or, you know, happiness or joy. It just refers to pleasant, unpleasant, and neutral. And love, in the Buddhist context, refers to the wish for others to have happiness and its causes. So very, very specific, meanings are very narrow. We tend to use words in our regular language very generally and very unspecifically, right? We don't have the discipline in our regular speech to be to define what we're saying really well, and so that creates a lot of misunderstandings. And one of the things that I have appreciated about our debate and logic class is how it really helped us be more specific in how we use language in what we refer to. And so now we're going to transition to our to the attachment portion of the book. And you know, the book alludes to multiple meanings of the word attachment. One form of attachment is necessary for our physical and psychological well-being. And another is one of what we call the three poisons. The first form of attachment is spoken of in psychology and refers to a feeling of closeness and connection among people. So some of examples of the beneficial forms of attachment that were mentioned include the attachment of a baby for his or her mother. Such attachment or bonding is necessary for the psychological well-being of the child. And there's nothing wrong with it and is expected. And in fact, if this bonding does not occur, then the child may develop some psychological problems as they grow up, some mental health issues. And so it's very important that this bonding takes place. This feeling of closeness, another positive example of this kind of attachment is a feeling of closeness present in families that enables them to function together as a unit. A kind of mutual respect based on knowing each other's capabilities and accepting them for what they are. Another example is the sense of unity between citizens of a country which helps them be harmonious and work for the benefit of the country. And bodhisattvas are said to be attached to sentient beings because they feel really a sense of closeness and a sense of responsibility for the welfare of each and every sentient being. So these forms of attachment, they produce good results, and some of them are even necessary for either the functioning of the individual or the functioning of society. But there's a very different form of attachment when we start insisting that our country or ourselves be the best one, when we don't care about anybody else, when we need to win at all cost. So when we get to that exaggeration, then we are kind of delving into troubled waters. And these good examples that were mentioned are also very different from the sticky, gooey attitude that says, you know, you belong to me, you need to be with me forever, we're never going to be separated, we're exclusively together, I would die without you, I need you to be happy, I cannot be happy with anyone else. When we start thinking in these ways, we are delving into the afflicted type of attachment, the one that we need to get rid of. So in Buddhism, attachment refers to one of the three poisons, one of the six root afflictions. And this attachment is a mental factor, and is that based on an exaggeration or projection of good qualities, clings to its desired object, which could be a person, an idea, a place, etc. With this attachment, we hunger after, crave, and cling to, and become obsessed with the object. So everyone here knows about my attachment. So I wanted to know if you can name some of the things that you might be strongly attached to. This is your level of playing field here.
Kind words. And yeah, that's the main. Actually, it goes the reverse. Averse to unkind words is the bigger of the two.
Yeah. Oh, those are, yeah, unkind words are just really hard to hear. It's one of the eight worldly concerns. We seek praise and we seek approval, and it's like it's a craving. It's like, I did something good, now I want to hear about it.
Actually, the reverse is the harder part.
The reverse is the hardest part for Venerable Tarpa, the aversion to harsh words. Other examples?
Since working in the kitchen, I've developed an attachment to the spices being in perfect alphabetical order.
All right, yeah. Keep that into account next time you're cooking.
I have strong attachment to approval, which comes in the forms of being liked or being trusted, things like that. And I would say, having worked on this for many years, that like Venerable Tarpa, the reverse, the attachment or the aversion to not having this or to hearing the opposite is worse. So I guess it's attachment to be separated from the opposite of that.
That's a very good example.
I will say this. It is a debilitating and devastating attachment. It is,
useless.
And painful. I get attached to people, there's no question about it. Family members, longtime friends. And this week we're going through saying bye-bye to our dear friends in Spokane. So I've done that meditation on, you know, separating from others endless numbers of times. It just sort of barely scratches the surface, because what am I feeling today? I'm feeling pain that I won't see them who knows when.
I'm attached to predictability and, well, it's been tested being here, that's for sure. I'm trying to let go, and also being special to other people.
Yeah. I'm alone in this one. When I see Kuni's car pull up, And Kuni is a fabulous cook.
Yeah.
And she cooks for the community. My attachment goes through the roof because I know that there's good food coming. And there is. It's a nice car, too.
Me too, I thought he was going to say the car. Yeah. That's a very good example. And I think you've touched upon something that is very, there's a real problem with attachment, is that it leads to unrealistic expectations. It leads to disappointments and difficulties when we discover that the object of our attachment does not possess all the wonderful qualities we thought it did, that it's not reliable, that it's impermanent. When we don't get it, or when we parted from it. And as all of you mentioned, that you've all experienced that. It's not, it's just one of the things that as humans we experience, to be separated from what we want and to not get what we want. So let's talk a little bit about, let's try to unpack a little bit more about what are some of the other disadvantages that are associated with attachment. Want to name a few out there, you guys? Some thoughts in addition to what we just mentioned? Yes, Venerable Lamsa.
Can't think clearly. You can't navigate reality clearly. Mm-hmm. Kind of like that craving in the mind, it just propels you towards obtaining what you wish, mm-hmm. with not much concern for other things, and no matter be they important to you, or when you're not in that craving state, you wouldn't act that way, but it propels you to not think clearly and then act in ways that are detrimental to yourself and others.
Yep, been there, done that. Animal champ.
I think that adds to that, it stimulates more afflictions coming up, mm-hmm. such as that jealousy or pride in, what else? Anger, of course, big one.
Big one. Yeah. What are the disadvantages you want to mention? It hurts. It's painful. Yeah.
You can reduce other people to objects to manipulate to get what you want.
Very true. Very true.
In my case of having an attachment to degrees and titles and labels, a lot of dissatisfaction of when I attain those things, mm. kind of a letdown.
Yeah.
Which leads to anger.
Yeah. Yeah.
Distracts me from practicing the Dharma.
Mm-hmm. Also true.
Big time.
It destroys our planet.
Mm-hmm.
It destroys our future life.
Yeah. Yeah. I was quite grateful when Venerable Chuni, after one of our EMLs, she put together this wonderful rock tumbler survival guide, which brings together some very nifty, very useful information, including a list of disadvantages of attachment and some quite nice attachment meditations. But I'm going to read just a couple from what she pulled together. This came from one of Venerable's books. It says, we create much negative karma through stealing, coveting, and so forth. It causes worry, anxiety, and frustration. It causes us to have unfortunate rebirth in the future, and is the chief cause for samsara in general. And it causes us to have attachment in future lives. Prevents us from having realizations and gaining liberation or enlightenment. We connive, I think this one was mentioned, we connive and plot to get what we want. We act hypocritically with ulterior motivations. And we go up and down emotionally. I mean, there's no way to have a stable mind when this is happening. And because of that, it is a huge hindrance to developing meditative concentration.
And we drag the people we care about the most along with us into this big pit.
Yes, we do. We do. Yes, we do. We certainly do. during the purification retreat, it was one of the things that I worked with. Is that at some point, I was doing this meditation on attachment, and attachment is such that it makes us think that we're being kind, caring, and loving with those around us. It's a complete illusion. It's like a masked enemy. It parades as a friend. It makes us think that we're being nice. But the kind thing to do is actually to help others get rid of attachment. And that is so hard to do because our conditioning tells us otherwise. And so what I was trying to do was just familiarize myself with that idea that this is not kindness. Hooking people into these attachments, strong attachments, is really not kind for them, not kind for us. But the mind has a very hard time with that concept. It's like you have to, like Venerable Samten was saying, we barely scratch the surface, even no matter how long we meditate on this, because that is so deep. It goes so deep. And the habituation is so strong. So going back to this thought of attachment being this huge hindrance to meditative concentration, I'm grateful that Christina gave me information about a webinar that Venerable did for Jewel Heart students, where she talked about meditative concentration, and she specifically talked about the five hindrances. And it was quite an eye opener, and I wanted to share that with you because it offers some very vivid and strong images of attachment that I think it can help us sort of juggle a little bit out of that illusion of it being good for us. And this came from a text that is quite known in the Chinese tradition. It's attributed to Nagarjuna, but for some reason it's not in the Tibetan canon. But it has these amazing descriptions of attachment. And the text is called Commentary to the Great Perfection of Wisdom Sutra. There's another word for it, but I can't. Something like that. Exegesis. Thank you. Let's start pronouncing that word. And so what Nagarjuna was offering in this particular text was some quite pointed metaphors about attachment. And I thought it would be fun as well as enlightening to think a little bit, contemplate these metaphors a little bit as a group, and then have a little bit of a go around to see what thoughts came up for you as we were contemplating this. You can write them down if you want. I'm going to read those metaphors, and then I'm going to pause a little bit between them to give you a chance to contemplate these metaphors, maybe write some thoughts, and then at the end, then we can maybe share if you want to share some of your thoughts on them, because I think they're amazing. So here it is. Desire, which is another word for attachment, is the net of demons, an entangling web from which it is difficult to escape. Desire is the net of demons, an entangling web from which it is difficult to escape. So just try to visualize that for a moment. Just see what comes up for you. see if you can try to connect with what Nagarjuna is trying to convey with these images. The next one is, desire constitutes a burning heat which dries up all bliss. Desire is like drying close to a fiery pit. It's extremely fearsome. To a fiery pit. It's extremely fearsome. It's extremely drying. Like getting dry, like you're wet and you're trying to get dry, and you're trying to do that by a fiery pit. Attachment is like cornering a venomous snake. Like an enemy invader brandishing a knife. Like swallowing molten copper. Like a lion blocking one's path. All of the desires are just like this and are worthy of being feared. Desires cause people to undergo torment and suffering. Would anyone like to share their thoughts on these metaphors? Miss Christina.
I like the first one, the net of demons, because when I've suffered because of attachment, when I haven't gotten what I've wanted or been disappointed, it feels like I'm in hell. I mean, for very strong attachments, not all attachments, but yeah, I've really felt like, ugh, this is approximating a hell realm. I know it's much worse, but it makes me realize how a hell realm could be possible, feeling so awful. And then an entangling web, yeah, it just really binds you. You can't escape, pretty much.
What struck me was there being a burning heat that dries up all bliss. Mm-hmm. The image came to mind of that, even very subtle, but it can be very strong, that restless energy that kind of I've seen just drives me to kind of
buzz around with this really dissatisfied, anxious energy of having to get what I want. That's with this kind of inner burning of, I've got to do this, get this, go there, do this. That's the whole process. And then the end result of that is dissatisfaction, but almost with this disbelief that the dissatisfaction is there, because the attachment still has this sort of like, oh, if I do this, then the happiness will come, but it doesn't.
It, you know, like the line blocking one's path. So it's kind of the end of you know, your precious human life to some extent. I mean, if you really go down the road. And I know from our own experience that you even can end up giving yourself up, you know, because you don't, you cling so much that you don't see any hope for other things.
I had kind of a similar thought to Venerable Jamba, and I thought of the quote from, I think it's Chandrakirti, just as a baby elephant falls into a deep chasm without, just as a baby elephant reaches for some grass at the edge of a deep chasm and falls in without obtaining any, so it is for those who like desire the joys of the three worlds. Mm-hmm. And so I just thought of how dangerous like attachment can be, and like often, I mean, I don't come close to realizing that on a daily basis, not even close. And it really, I mean, it shows where I am in my practice, that I have a long way to go.
That reminds me of this drying close to a fiery pit too. You know, it's very dangerous. And it's like, if you make a false move, there you go, and burn up. So
the kind of mind that is attached is just this exaggeration, and we lose sight of everyone else. Mm-hmm. And then we will, I have done things that I've profoundly regretted because I'm hell-bent on getting the object, whatever it is. Mm-hmm. And it is actually a frightening state of mind in retrospect.
Yeah.
I think the net of demons is the strongest one for me too, because this sense of being entangled by exaggeration, and then, you know, the grasp that, you know, the all the tendrils that go out trying to acquire and trying to hold and maintain, and oh man, it is a deadly, deadly, deadly net. Yeah. Very difficult to escape.
Yeah. Swallowing a molten copper is... yeah, I just can't imagine. It's like you're all this fiery substance that is burning you as you swallow, and it's one of those images. Like, it does feel like that sometimes when you're in the middle of the attachment thing. It's like the pain and the torment that it produces. I can totally relate to this image of the molten copper. You know, here you're thinking that you're eating or indulging in something that's sweet and wonderful, and what ends up happening is that you're burned by it. You're burned by it in so many ways. So thanks for sharing. But you know Nagarjuna, he doesn't stop. He always has many angles for seeing one thing, and there is more. So we're going to do the same thing with these others, because, again, it's so rich. And I'm hoping that I will add these to my meditation menu. And so I'm hoping that you can also use them in your meditations to kind of help you get some distance from what you're attached to. So here we go. It says, those people, all of us, who are attached to desire are like convicts in a prison. Like a deer caught in a trap. Like birds ensnared in a net. like fish who have swallowed a hook. Like a crow in the midst of a band of owls. Think about those for a moment. And then he continues. Desires are like blind men approaching an abyss. Like a fly caught in hot oil. Like a peaceful man caught up in a military combat. Like one who licks a honey-smeared blade. Anyone wants to share your reactions or thoughts on these particular metaphors? Venerable Jampa says, don't eat it. You know, this one, like bird's snare in a net, I remember last year when the apple tree was covered by a net to protect the fruit. There was at least one instance, maybe more, of a bird getting caught in it, in the net covering the tree. And the poor creature was just really trying hard to get out of it, to get free from it, just flapping the wings and trying to move away, but couldn't. You know, it was really hooked into it and was exerting all kinds of energy and getting tired. And finally, I think someone noticed it, and Venerable Semkye went to set it free. And even though Venerable Semkye was trying to set it free, it was afraid of Venerable Semkye and not really, trying to even get away from her while still being caught in this net, and the anxiety, the suffering that poor bird was undergoing was quite sad to see, but. You know, Venerable Semkye, she's quite adept at dealing with creatures and animals. And so she was able to free the bird from the net and let it go. But yeah, that was the first thing that came to mind, was that instance of the bird and how, you know, even if we try to get away from the attachment, it's like we're caught in there and we are suffering. We know we're suffering. We want to get away from the suffering, but we can't. So it's definitely, for me, a very powerful image.
Thinking about an upcoming BBC, before it hit some time in Germany, there's an astronaut, Alexander Gerst, and he was the second time up in space. So I think there are not many people, like over 500, who have been so far in space for longer. And his perspective on life, on how to live, changed completely. So he saw from above how fragile this planet is, and that we are so grasping and creating this destruction, you know, between nations and all the wars, like you know, mentioned in the beginning, race differentiation. That doesn't exist when you look from above, when you take the wider perspective.
Mm-hmm.
And it became for him very clear that we are destroying ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
So clear. It's good to hear from somebody who people look up to him, you know, and listen, because he has such a good view.
Yes, very moving, very powerful, very convincing.
Animals, they're headed towards their death, basically. They've been tricked and by something kind of more clever than them, and then unbeknownst to them, they've fallen into a trap, and then that's it. There's no escape, and so attachment is what keeps us trapped in samsara, so having death after death after death, it's just like that.
Yeah. Luckily, I think the Buddha had such compassion, and our teachers after him, a long lineage of wonderful teachers who have made the Buddha's teachings come alive for all of us. We have antidotes for attachment. We've been provided with the medicine that we need to take to relieve our suffering due to attachment. It does take a long time, as we know, but they're there. So, can you name some of the antidotes? Can you name antidotes for attachment? Anyone? Christina?
Reflect on impermanence.
Yeah,
Manuel mentioned everything won't last.
Yeah, Manuel mentioned that. Certainly.
I tried to contemplate the problems or, you know, other issues that will arise if I obtain this object or situation that I am so attached to.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a good one. Venerable also mentioned that's one of her ways to deal with this. Like, what would happen if I get everything that I want? What after that? What then? Thinking about the disadvantages, yeah. Thinking, really contemplating the disadvantages. So, again, I'm gonna read for the one from the wonderful Rock Tumblr Survival Guide. the first one is remembering the disadvantages. The impermanence. Even if I get what I like, will bring me ultimate and lasting happiness. So thinking, really asking ourselves that question. Even if I get what I want, would that be it? Would that be lasting? Remembering that we have had similar pleasures infinite times in past lives, and it hasn't gotten us nowhere. Mentally dissecting the object or person into its parts and trying to find what it is that seems so desirable about it. And then considering how our mind creates the beautiful object by interpreting it a certain way and giving it the label beautiful, and then confusing our concept with the object itself, confusing the label with the object itself. So those are just some antidotes. Yes?
I do think that absolutely none of these work until we've come to grips with the fact that that attachment actually is really harmful. You can look at the interpermanence of an object all day long and try to convince yourself that, oh, I'm not attached because it's going to die. And until we're convinced that the attachment itself is the problem, they're not so effective.
Yeah, very true. And let me reveal a little bit about the thickness of ignorance in my mind. Because up until quite recently, I didn't know I was attached to my daughter. I mean, there was just no concept of that. Even though I've heard so many teachings in attachment, I had, it's like, no, not me. I'm not
not exaggerating anything. What am I exaggerating? I couldn't make the meditation on attachment work for that particular instance. And it took like a year of hitting my head against that meditation and coming up with nothing. And then one day out of the blue, I don't remember if I think I might have been sitting in the hall trying to ponder something different. And then the word exaggeration came, and then all of a sudden I said, I know what I'm exaggerating. I can't see right now what is it that I'm exaggerating. So we have to know. I think it's important to understand what it is that we're exaggerating and how we are exaggerating in order to be able to counter that. And the moment that I was able to pinpoint the exaggeration, the wrong way of looking at it, then the meditation became more flavorful. I have more to sink my teeth into, my mental teeth into, with that meditation, because before that I had nothing to work with. And so for me that was really a turning point to really understand how, you know, where I was getting stuck, where the stuckness. And of course, it's a number of layers. You know, you address one layer, then something else come up, and something else come up. And with this, certainly there's a feeling, certainly there's a strong feeling component. But behind the feeling are all of our wrong conceptions, our thoughts. That are behind this attachment, that if we don't unpack those thoughts and look at them with some Buddhist wisdom, then they're hard to give up. They're hard to give up. And even if you go at them one by one, it's like, I'm doing a net of wrong thoughts, that where one connects with another. Through association. And so it's like, okay, here's one. Oh, there's one associated with that. Oh, that one's associated with. Oh, and there goes the other one. And so for me, it's been a work of identifying all of these thoughts that are not realistic, that are not based on wisdom, and then try to work with, to dispel each one of those wrong ways of thinking.
Because all of samsara runs on attachment, then everything that we ever learned from the second we were conceived also runs on attachment.
Yeah.
So, you know, our attachment, I mean, our loyalty to our family, or what we think is appropriate behavior around the family, or, you know, especially around mating and continuing the species and all the things that we do around that, are so, I mean, we're just drenched mm-hmm. in attachment being the way to go, which is also really hard to, you know, part the water a little bit and see what's really there.
Yeah. And you know what's scary now that you say that, is that what's scary is that in doing this work, the mind keeps on thinking that I'm destroying the love. By going after the attachment, it's like, oh, you're destroying the love, the affection, the care, the connection. It really fools us to believe that that's what we're doing. And who wants to do that? I don't. I don't want to stop loving my child. I don't want to stop the connection with her. I don't want to stop caring. And so then what I need to do is pull that away. Let's put that away for, you know. I'll focus on anger. Let me focus on something else. That's safest. That's not getting so much to my core. And so it's really one of the things that, for me, it's like a very delicate surgery. Very delicate surgery, because at the same time that I'm trying to piece these out, take this string out, at the same time, I'm trying to convince myself, This is not going to affect my relationship. This is not going to affect my love. This is not going to affect my care. Because when my mind goes into that direction, all hell breaks loose. Fear comes up quite strongly. And so, but it's because of that. Because from the moment that we are come out of the wound, we confuse love and attachment. We think this is one and the same, and it isn't. So no wonder it takes a long time to do this work.
No, I was at the dentist, and the woman there, she, asking what we did and retreat, and she's kind of, this is nothing for her. And she said, you know, but God told us we have to be socializing, we have to be there for others, we have to communicate. And she didn't say that from her perspective, she's not contemplative, but God, you know, putting a religion then in front of it. So that was also, for me, interesting to see that people have this perspective and holding on so strongly that, and therefore don't explore their mind and possibilities.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it becomes a barrier to really understanding how they create the suffering, a barrier to growth, a barrier to spiritual development, I think. One of the things that I don't know if we talked enough about is the expectations that we set when we are attached to an object or a person. You know, this is the expectations of that object and that person has to be there to satisfy my need for love, for affection, for well-being, for you name it. And when that expectation is not met, then anger is generated, disappointment, which then is directed towards that object, not toward that person. So eventually they suffer from our reaction to the disappointment because we have imputed all these expectations upon them. And that's just not very conducive to a good relationship either. So I think I have come to the end of my talking points here. But before we close, I just wanted to remind everyone of the takeaways, some takeaways or reflections that are highlighted in this section. We talked about the common meanings of the English word for attachment. So it's good to remember those. It's good to remember the disadvantages of the afflictive type of attachment. Venerable Chuni was saying it's very true that one of the antidotes to it is to know the disadvantages. And then keeping in mind also, you know, how easy it is to really tell when we're slipping into exaggeration and expectations.